Well, like everybody else, I'm going to start by thanking everyone who conceived and organized the conference. I think you all, Amy, Patrick, everyone here has really cracked the code as to how you roll out a digital project. Because get people to come here and invest in it, and then show people what it can do so it doesn't sit there in just a static way. And it isn't just a, if we build it, they will come, but kind of get people to come in early enough to make suggestions about what you can build, how it can be extended, how it can be used to get that community buy-in. So I think you've really done a great job of putting together a pretty seamless workshop here. I've run workshops myself, but the way you go this smoothly. And bringing sense into folks into a sense of a common cause. I think that's important too, so that we feel like we're all on the same team and rooting for this to work. So I just want to thank you for that. And then I want to apologize because to all the other panelists, because my paper is without question the most rushed and the least realized of all that we contributed. And so what I'm going to do is, like one of Bramlett's petitioners, I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of the workshop model and ask you to really, really help me make it better. And this is something that I believe in, and it is a true workshop conference. So instead of presenting what my paper says, I'm going to present what I wish it said, or what I was trying to do. And then maybe you can help me actually do it, and then I can get somewhere with it, and it can be more worthy of our collective effort. As Amy says, in some ways, in my remarks, I'm bringing this back to the beginning, to Luther's paper, to Carol's paper. I don't think that we, I mean, I know that I haven't yet figured out exactly what this archive is, and I want really for us maybe at the end to study it. In the paper, I call it a gubernatorial panopticon, which I thought was a kind of funny thing, but the more I thought about it, actually, it kind of works. Not in a Jeremy Bentham sense, but in a Foucault sense. What is actually most represented in this archive is the thing that you almost never directly see, the largely invisible governor. The view of the state as it seeks to discipline and punish and interpret, as Luther says, what claims are legitimate by the state, and tries to stabilize a regime that has been deeply destabilized. That's what this archive really is, it seems to me. We're trying to do other things with it, but I think I want to recognize what it actually is in itself. So I hope we'll come back to that point in our discussion. For those of you who haven't read my paper, good, thank you. I'm summarizing super, super quickly. So I begin with this homage to the archive itself. I became an historian precisely because in my early 20s, I fell in long love with the archive. I really didn't know what I was doing. A sense of my uncertainty was that I applied to law school and was going to go to that. And then I wandered into the Southern Historical Collection and fell in love with the archive. To me, archives are places where vast secrets had gone and died, and I could unlock them and learn them. And as I've written elsewhere, for me, thinking on the dead is like laying in the grass and staring at the stars and pondering on all the people who have gone before. I feel humbled by and connected to the great and ever unfolding drama of human being. So you get the idea, hopeless romantic about the archive. I had this faith in what we were doing. And gradually, by degrees, that faith has been shaken. It probably started even before Ann Stoller's article, Colonial Archives and the Acts of Governance, in 2002. It culminated when I read Harvey Genius in Two Acts, which honestly I've never recovered from reading that. If you haven't read it, you must. If you have read it, you probably know what I mean. It is one of the most haunting, moving, hopeful, despairing indictments and celebrations of the archive that you'll ever read. But suffice to say that over the last 20 years, I began my degrees to look back upon my graduate school experience quite differently. I'd written my dissertation, which became my first book, The Southern Historical Collection at UNC, without ever asking how that archive got built. That archive got built in the 1930s when J.D. Derulac Hamilton drove around the Ford plantation asking his daughters, do you have any of your daddy's letters? And so that becomes the historical collection at UNC, which is remarkable. It is an absolutely remarkable collection, but it is also a monument to the Leeway families. It is a monument to those who have the time to write letters and the continuity of real estate, of title, of all kinds of things to be able to hand those papers down in direct lineage. So now, whenever I come to an archive, I'm an emotional mess from from the very start. Because the more famous Athenian who said, I am losing my religion. And so when Amy asked me what I wanted to write on, I decided I wanted to write not from, but of this archive. Because I've come to the conclusion that every archive needs to come with a user's name. Every archive needs to come with a warning label. We need to develop a set of metrics and tools that allow us to see the archive at scale and to see it for what it is whole. And for those of us working on African American history, we're going to read this thing and use the brain. We need a deep, deep, analytically precise sense of what that brain might be. So I'm a big believer, I talk to my students a lot about form follows function in writing. And that's what I was trying to do with this piece, and it was, I'm sure, totally lost on you, because even when I look at it, I don't quite see either what the form or function are supposed to be. But my mantra is that our arguments, to the extent they can, should be buried at the level of structure. The structure itself should be carrying some of the analytical weight and doing some of the analytical work. So here's where I wasn't successful, but I was trying to give you a sense of how you come into an archive, how you lost in an archive, how you get your bearings in an archive, how your searches get more precise as you understand its limits and lineaments, and then you find its heart. That was the idea of what I was trying to do, and I understand completely that it doesn't come across. And it all begins where we all began, which is at the search bar, which I wanted to interrogate the search bar itself, which has become this sort of dominant feature of our lives and how we interact with virtually everything. That's all Google is, it's just this giant search bar. And it returns things to us without telling us everything, essentially, that is out there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what it means to search in that way, and behind that, what exactly are we searching against? So, as if you've read the paper, again, I'm sorry, but the first thing, I don't know how we share this kinship, but the first word I typed into the search bar was in fact, Negro. What it returns, I know, is not African-Americans, it's not the Black experience, and it's not them in their own words. These are white projections of Black people, essentially. But we can try to interrogate these projections of the white mind. And so the first thing I noticed is what Luther noticed and explicated for us so perfectly, which is that it's a staggering amount of template cases. I mean, it is ridiculous. It's 22% of these 249 documents that have the word Negro in them are involved of all these template cases. Now, putting that in perspective, 249, right? If you type in the word slave, it returns 286. And if you type in the word murder, it returns 451. If you type in the word horse, it returns 502. What does that mean? I don't know that it means anything, actually. I don't think it means that horses are more important, or murder is more important to Kentuckians than anything else. But I do think it was a way to try to figure out what I'm not looking for, how much of what I'm not looking for is there, and what is its nature, to get something from that. I think that the tippling laws are absolutely directed at sort of trying to contain the conduct and behavior of African Americans. I think they're also trying to construct and contain the behavior of whites. So I'm a big fan of Jeff Ford's book, Race Relations at the Margins, in which he's constantly talking about the antipathy that the master class is trying to breed between poor whites and slaves because they're worried about fraternization, collusion. They're really worried about an underground economy that is fencing and stealing and moving things around. And they're worried about grog shops, which are overspread across the South. They're not a number of a big part of that. So, sure, there's a huge ton of that. But then what I wanted to do is how many of these projections of the white mind are actually negative? That is, that the Black image of the white mind is actually violent and is going to do violence to them. And what is fascinating to me is it's unbelievably low when they're talking about people they know. Part of that is a factor of the nature of the archive itself, right? These are petitions. So you have people on the side of these Negroes, and that's part of it. But I don't think it's only that, because if you look at how when they use the word Negro in the abstract, it's virulently negative. And so I am left with this idea that they don't loathe Blacks as a race. They loathe the idea that the race might rise. And this they loathe with an antipathy that is white hot. this archive is radioactive when it comes to whites looking at the possibility for some slippage or some threat to white supremacy. And then it hits them at the amygdala, at an emotional core that pulses quite strongly. And I think we might talk a little bit about the emotions of that. So I started with that, and I'll just sort of finish. Then I went on, I just wanted to go on something that's totally personal, so I looked up monomania, which having worked on Poe, I've looked a lot. Monomania is a word that they use, peaks, the use of the word peaks, in 1855. And I sort of riffed on how these new psychiatric categories are going to become available to the middle class so that they can excuse themselves from legal penalties that they will suggest should better fall on poor people. And then what I was trying to say is that I was in the structure that you don't understand because I haven't narrated it right, that I'm lost there. I've become too personal, my own sort of interests, I'm looking for them again, and I need to back away and ask this archive a general question of who are you? So that's why I end with these two searches. Who? What do you dream? Oh, archive, what do you dream? And what's fascinating about this archive and extraordinarily telling is that the archive only dreams in the negative. So it's a poor white party who I served a, you know, an African American a beer, never dreaming. I mean, the incapacity of Kentuckians for their nocturnal, you know, imagination is staggering. Because it's only never dreamed. Never dreamed that would happen, and I can't again, almost exclusively. Nobody dreams of anything remotely positive. And that was telling to me because I've done a bunch of work on another archive of soldiers' letters, and there the dreams are richly located. I mean, it's like they want to be far away, they want to be near you, they want to be anywhere else, and it's just a very different dreaming. And I end with what does this archive think is evil? And so I expected just to get one necessary people, one Kentuckian that remembered that once upon a time you said that slavery was necessary, but you at least admitted it was evil. No. Nobody. Evil is loose African Americans. Evil is emancipation. Evil is, again, the rock they'll die on, which is any step toward political equality. So I'll just end with this idea that I hope we come back to this question of how we can develop what I call the Bechdel test. Some kind of way to test an archive for just how biased it might be.